In case it had escaped the attention of any regular listeners to this podcast, shipping is getting increasingly more complex and more expensive. Now, I don't expect everybody to agree with me on this, but I would argue that is, on balance, a good thing, in that it forces the hand of an industry that has been too cheap for too long, and the direction of regulatory travel favours the progressives over the laggards now. But we don't know the detail, of course. We don't know what fuel availability or costs look like. We don't know the detail of what market-based mechanism or fuel standard is going to emerge, or even if it will. We don't know when ships ordered today are realistically going to be filling their dual-fuel tanks with which fuels at what price. And that makes decisions today about new buildings difficult.
Difficult, but not impossible. Of course there are huge uncertainties to consider, and no order in shipping ever came without risk. Any owner who tells you that they ordered at the right time and the right price is lying, unless they are retrospectively assessing that deal after the ship has been scrapped. You just don't know what the future holds in shipping. But it is possible, I would say, to make the least worst decision and factor in sufficient amounts of flexibility to be reasonably sure that the order you place today is not going to be a stranded asset in the next decade. And yet, large swathes of the industry seem to be using the energy transition as an excuse for inaction right now. So I thought I should introduce you hesitant fence-sitters to some persuasive expertise, advocating for a fully risk-assessed case for progressive change. James Frew is a business consultancy director at Lloyd's Register, and he spent a lot of his time advising clients on how to make the decisions that come with least regrets when it comes to new building and optimization. Now, I'm going to get to his recommendation shortly, but I wanted to start with that question of complexity, because it's hard being a ship owner these days. We expect ship owners to be financiers, politicians, defence experts, and now we're expecting them to have a PhD in chemical engineering just to talk about their bunkering options. But does the industry really have that level of expertise at its disposal? And is the industry able to deal with that complexity of the decisions they have to make right now?
So I think that complexity comes from two places. I think as a pure technical problem, I think the industry's got the capacity to solve it. I think the challenge is marrying a technical solution with something that's going to be commercially viable, or at least where a commercial business case can be made to the ship owner. I personally actually think that you can make a good case for a new building today that's commercially viable, potentially, you know, spending a bit more money on the least regrets options. But making that case to the ship owner or to the CFO, I think is something that, to be honest, technical departments aren't used to having to make that sort of commercial case. So I think that's one angle. The other angle of complexity that's challenging there is around the fuels and the upstream procurement of the fuels. We've seen one of the biggest names in the industry get into some questions, at least, as to sort of the upstream procurement of those fuels. I think more broadly, shipping as an industry is very used to being able to burn residual fuel that conveniently is provided to it by the refining industry without really the shipping industry having to think very hard about the matter, to be perfectly honest. And it's going to have to move to a situation where if it wants to burn a fuel that's a non-fossil fuel, it's going to have to actively procure that fuel. And I think you sort of saw that a bit with LNG bunkering, where you sort of saw the length of contracts and fuel offtake contracts stretch a bit. But I think that's, as I come back, that's only a very baby step compared to what you're going to need to seriously incentivize someone to drop sort of $3-4 billion on a green fuel production facility at scale, be it ammonia, be it methanol.
Okay, so the investment decisions that shipping needs to make today are significantly more complex than they were even a few years ago. We know that. But let's take a step back before we get stuck into the detail and talk about where we are right now, because we have made progress. At the IMO, the agenda is moving at pace. Orders are being made by boards all the time. We are seeing daily headlines about projects that have now moved from trial to real investment.
James is someone in the thick of these decisions being taken right now. So how does he characterise shipping's broad arc of decarbonisation and its journey right now?
So what I'd say is I think there's been a real step change even in the last 2 years or so, where we've seen far greater interest across the board in decarbonisation. Ship owners that historically have been perceived as being very, very conservative in their approach now are actively engaging. I think the other really big shift we've seen is strong engagement from the charterers. So we're working with a number of the major trading houses in Geneva. We're working with some of the large mining companies, some of the large energy companies as well, looking at specifically how they can decarbonize their maritime operations. And obviously, you know, if you speak to a classic ship owner about this, about decarbonization, then their answer will be, well, I need the charter's support. And to be honest, that's been a major barrier to decarbonizing vessels. That sort of the attitude or the requirement to wait for the charterer, and the charterer often not being there for a conversation around supporting decarbonisation with some kind of an incentive, be that a longer term charter, be that a higher charter rate. So I think that's been the big shift. As a progress check, though, I mean the IMO's sort of decarbonisation targets are pretty ambitious, and there's a lot to be done. There's an awful lot to be done, and we're only just, I feel we're only really as an industry just starting that journey. And I say that not to be disrespectful to people who've been working on this for a decade or more, but just recognising in terms of sort of the scale of the mountain we have to climb, we really are only just in the foothills.
So as we sit here at Basecamp contemplating the ascent we have to make to 2050, I want to focus this week on the decisions we are taking now, rather than what we might be deciding at some indeterminate point in the future when the conditions are right, etc., etc. I've talked about the disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality of green shipping investments before on this podcast, but I wonder if the somewhat conceptual conclusions coming out of the IMO's MEPC meetings are always directly connected to the daily decisions that are coming out of the board meetings from shipping companies.
I think they certainly are. I think the interesting thing is that in some cases we do see decisions being made, companies moving forward with investments, both in terms of sort of retrofitting and in terms of actually designing and building new assets. But I think in many cases the energy transition is actually something of an excuse for inaction. We see companies sort of, you know, preferencing secondhand. Secondhand assets above new buildings, because there's that huge huge sort of question around what the future fuel is. I think there's sort of two positions where we are sort of speaking to our clients about the opportunities in that space. The first is around sort of trying to say, look, that you can't do a point optimization, and by which I mean, you design a ship that will be perfect in 2035, depending, you know, for a set of technological developments, for a set of fuel availability and fuel price points that are, to be honest, unknowable. Whatever anyone with the greatest tech says to you, 2035 will look like. And I say that as someone with 15 years experience of trying to forecast shipping markets. You know, that's not going to be possible. So I don't think you can do a point optimization. But I think you can have a least regrets option and try and model through the different alternative futures in 2035 in terms of what that looks like, in terms of fuel availability, in terms of what that looks like as the hydrogen economy, how technological gateways like electrolyzer technology are pushing the world down certain pathways, what things like carbon capture look like. And you say, okay, for these set of futures, what measures can we take now in terms of building a new building that mean that both we aren't going to sit around regretting it, and also we will have a clear idea and a clear risk management strategy for any capex we do need to put into the vessel to make it future fit. I think that's the first point I'd make, Richard. The second point is that to me, there is an economic value, or there will be an economic value, for having a new and modern ship on the water in 2030, even if that ship's building VLSFO. And I think what we're seeing is historic underinvestment in certain sectors, particularly for tanker and bulker, where you've got aging fleets, where you've obviously got a large share of the fleet that was built in response to the super boom of sort of 2005 to 2007, which will be coming up to 20 years old at the end of this decade. And that reality of the fleet age profile is gonna sort of clash with charterer requirements for decarbonisation and incremental decarbonisation that they've made, both in terms of their shareholder commitments, maybe in terms of the Sea Cargo Charter as well. So they're going to be needing modern tonnage just at the time that modern tonnage isn't available. And in our view, that actually there will be an economic premium being paid for ships that are being ordered today, delivered in 27, 28, and that will be on the water at a time when charterers are desperate to charter more efficient vessels to show progress in terms of sort of decarbonisation, but where you may not have sort of the future fuels, the your sort of e-ammonias or biomethanols available to facilitate that decarbonisation. So I think the new buildings, at least, those are the two areas we're looking at.
It used to be that if you were ordering a ship or looking at buying a second-hand ship, the key concerns would be, can I safely operate this ship? Can I operate it at break-even, where overall I'm likely to be able to make my money back? Now, I'm not saying that was easy, but things are more complex now. Now you have to concern yourself with levels of compliance unforeseeable by your predecessors. What happens if I go into Europe? What does my strategy around carbon look like? What technologies am I going to need on this vessel now and in the future? But there's also a wider calculation bubbling away in the background, because you're essentially now dealing with two scenarios. One with today's fuel price in mind, and one where fuels could potentially be three or four times today's price. Now, those capex decisions on today's price, they don't make any sense. But if you're planning a scenario where you're buying a very expensive green scalable ammonia, for example, things do start to make sense once that fuel becomes sufficiently available and expensive.
Yeah, 100%. I actually think it's even more complex at the moment, actually, where you've got sort of a three-dimensional optimizational problem where you have to optimize across time. So building a ship that's competitive today but will be compliant towards the end of its life in the 2040s. You have to optimize across operational region, because obviously at the moment, if you're trading into Europe, we used the example of wind before, you know, the EU, Fuel EU, will give you a bit of help with the economics of a wind retrofit, whereas internationally that won't be the case. And or at least we do not know that it will be the case. Maybe I should put more conservatively. And you're also optimizing across client type, because it's not a secret that there are different clients in the industry, some of which you've got a sensible chance of getting some support for retrofittable technology, and some that, to be honest, you will really only care about the bottom dollar, and that will really be it. So yeah, fully agree with you that there's that three-dimensional optimizational problem. And one of the most complex parts of that is the fact that you need to apply a marginal abatement cost to a technology that isn't the price of fuel today. And I think that's what a lot of owners are going, in my opinion, or need. I don't want to say going wrong, I don't want to tell them their business, but certainly a more sophisticated look at it would be to say, look, realistically, the total cost of burning a fuel tomorrow is going to be significantly higher than it is today. Whether that's green ammonia or whether that's because there's a global fuel standard and a market-based mechanism that's going to make burning VLSFO more expensive, you know, that the cost of your cost of fuel will significantly increase. Our modelling suggests according to some of the work we've done, in 2040 to 2050, the cost of burning fuel will be around three times what it is today. That's either the that's based on e-fuels and biofuels, and I can talk about the transition between the two, but those are obviously higher costs, particularly in the case of e-fuels coming down as you hit technological maturity. And at the same time, the cost of burning a traditional fuel like VLSFO increasing significantly as a result of both global fuel standards and the sort of a GHG, some kind of GHG market-based mechanism.
The other complicating factor that is perhaps not being captured in some of the planning being talked about openly is aviation. If you look at the standards for sustainable aviation fuel and how much sustainable aviation fuel planes are going to have to burn in and out of the EU in 2030, 2035 and through to 2040, you can pretty much map the demand for aviation fuel onto the supply of biofuels generally. And looking at what share is going to be left over for shipping should certainly be part of the current thinking in boardrooms. I think it's fair to say that e-fuels are going to have to be part of the shipping mix sooner or later. So if you're building a ship today to burn methanol, it may burn VLSFO, then start to burn biomethanol, then transition to burn e-methanol through its life. That transition is another part of that complexity. The other point is that, as we mentioned at the beginning of this week's edition, while we may not know the detail of the regulation yet to be finalised, we do know the direction. In Europe, FuelEU Maritime has been specifically designed to incentivise you to burn green fuels. And if we see what's coming out of the IMO emerge with a similar sort of design to incentivise you to at least burn some of that green fuel, that is going to be a system-wide issue for the industry where it adds more complexity. And that complexity is a particular problem for the small tramp owner demographic of the industry. It likely won't bother Maersk or Cargill, but large swathes of the industry are going to have to rethink their fuel procurement strategies, and it's not going to be easy. Regular listeners, of course, will have heard me argue before that it is going to be increasingly difficult to be a small ship owner in the future. And it seems that James is of a similar mindset to me on the issues of scale.
Well, I must admit, I've also been in the school of arguing that for quite a number of years as well. Even talking about things like sort of the SECA zones in 2015 and then the sulfur cap and so on and so forth, saying that, you know, all this is going to make it harder to be a small ship owner. I must admit, to date, the small ship owners have proved surprisingly resilient and defied all predictions. They've been able to survive by not needing to comply with arduous global regulation. And I think that the global regulation is coming. How arduous it will be is TBD, at least I think, along with a lot of the industry, we hope it will at least create a level playing field that will broadly deliver on the IMO's targets. And I think we're going to see that. Then that business model will need to evolve. And it might evolve by giving increasing chunks of risk management, outsourcing increasing chunks of risk management. Because at the moment, what the small ship owners, at least as an industry as a whole, are very good at, it is risk management. You know, five owners may get it wrong out of 100, and those five go bankrupt and are replaced. But, you know, they are pretty good at risk management. I think that it will be very difficult for them to manage and allocate capital across that risky landscape of fuels, of charterers, and of the technical side, whereas at the moment they're really only focused on the technical risk management and the risk on the financial risk management associated with the charter.
Well, I feel we've scared you enough with predictions of change and complexity to come, so that's where we're going to leave it this week. My thanks to James and Lloyd's Register for this one, and thank you for listening. We are going to be back shortly with more on the story shaping shipping. But for now, stay safe out there. Bye.